Hey friends, here we are, another week, another episode of the Semi-Seminarian. We're continuing our Bible study series we're calling the Bible for Grown-Ups. In this episode, we're in part 10 of our look at the Acts of the Apostles. This time, our study is called Paul, the original Teflon Don. And in this episode, Luke, the writer of the Acts of the Apostles, are going to show us four individual times where Paul is brought before the authorities. And in this case, Paul is going to make the argument that Christianity is not a threat to the Roman Empire whatsoever. I'll see you on the other side. Acts chapters 23, 24, 25, and 26. We're going to look at these final four times that Paul is brought before some type of court or tribunal to plead his case before he finally ends up in Rome. And that's kind of his story on the way to Rome involves a shipwreck, and it's kind of an adventure all in of itself. But what we find with tonight's lesson, as we have looked at Luke, the writer of the Acts of the Apostles, as we've looked at the way that he's chronicled the missionary journeys of Paul, the way that Paul has converted people to Christianity, but at times had run into trouble with officials, we find that Luke ultimately commits the ultimate party foul. Because in the Acts of the Apostles, what we find are the story in his stories of Paul are the two things that you never talk about at a party: religion and politics. Till now, Luke's recordings of Paul's speeches have been about religion, or more precisely, theology or Christology. In other words, Paul has been, when his speeches have been recorded, it has been about why you should change your mind from, say, being a Gentile pagan or being a Jewish person and becoming a Christian because of the nature of Christ. But that now, in these last four speeches, we're going to see his talk shift from religion to politics. In these next four chapters, we're going to see Paul making his case four different times with different words and with different audiences, but with one unifying message. And that is that Christianity does not break the law. In the face of sedition, or the charge of stirring up or fomenting political unrest, Paul is making his case in these four chapters, and successfully so, that he and Christianity are innocent of the charges of breaking the law. So let's begin tonight with chapter 23, verse 1. If you recall, we dropped off last time with Paul being brought before the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Paul looks straight at the Sanhedrin. "My brothers," he says, "I have always done my duty to God, and to this very day, I feel that I have done nothing wrong." Ananias, the high priest, heard this. So he ordered the men standing by near Paul to hit him in the mouth. Now, I want to stop right here and talk about this guy, Ananias, for just one second. Ananias was named the high priest of the Sanhedrin in the year 47. And actually, Ananias was a very corrupt guy. He seized the tithes that were meant for lower priests. He was also extremely pro-Roman in his policies. And when the war broke out with Rome in 66, he actually hid from his own people in an aqueduct. He was discovered by Jewish insurgents and dragged with his brother, a brother, to their place of execution. So he was executed by his own people. Then Paul said to him, "You pretender, God will hit you. You sit there and judge me by the law, but you yourself broke the law when you commanded them to hit me." Those who were standing near Paul said, "How dare you talk like that to God's high priest?" Paul replied, "Brothers, I didn't realize he was the high priest. It is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" That is written in Exodus chapter 22, verse 28. Now, we're not to suppose that Paul, being a Sanhedrin himself, would not have been able to recognize the high priest. The argument Paul is making here is the high priest wouldn't have ever ordered a defendant to be punished in court, like being punched in the mouth. The rights and the rules of witnesses was held in very high regard within the Jewish court system. So he's saying, you ordered these guys to hit me. Obviously, you can't be the high priest. The high priest wouldn't have done something like that. Paul knew that some of them were Sadducees and others were Pharisees. Sure enough, this Sanhedrin, this Supreme Court, right, is made up of these two religious and political parties, the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees. So he called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers," he said, "I am a Pharisee. I'm the son of a Pharisee. I believe that people will rise from the dead, and that is why I'm on trial." And whenever you boil all of it down, whenever you boil Christianity down, basically that's it in one sentence. We believe that you can rise from the dead, right? And he's saying, that's why I'm here in front of you. That's the law that I've broken. Now, is he saying this about being a Pharisee? He says, "I'm a Pharisee and my father's a Pharisee." Is he saying this to brag? Is he saying, look, I'm not like these other Gentile or pagan people that have become Christians, right? I look at my beard, man. I'm like you guys. I think we miss the point when we read Paul's words, because he's actually on trial for preaching things and stating beliefs that are supposed to be untrue, right? That's why he's been charged. He's charged with inventing stories, and that's why he's on trial. But Paul says, he says something to them that may in the 21st century be lost on us, but it wouldn't have been lost on the Sanhedrin. Paul is saying, I'm charged because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. He says, but I'm a Pharisee. Guys, we're Pharisees. We all believe in the resurrection of the dead. Right? You there in the Sanhedrin, you who's a Pharisee, you believe in the resurrection of the dead too. It's one of the things that makes you a Pharisee. Why aren't you on trial? When he said this, the Pharisees and the Sadducees started to argue. They began to take their respective sides. The Sadducees say that people will not rise from the dead. They don't believe that they're angels or spirits either, but the Pharisees believe all of these things. People were causing trouble and making a lot of noise, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and they argued strongly. Look, we find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? Then the arguing got out of hand. The commanding officer was afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces to those who were arguing. So he ordered the soldiers to go down and take him away from there by force. They were supposed to bring him into the fort. The next night, the Lord stood near Paul and he said, "Be brave. You've given witness about me in Jerusalem. You must do the same in Rome." And we're going to find this particular prophecy come true at the end of this book. From the moment that Paul is arrested here onwards, the narrative becomes much more full than before. It still continues true of Luke's method of concentrating the reader's attention on certain selective scenes. He would zip into a scene happening at a particular place at a particular time and then zip out, and there might be periods of time that go by. And it might seem like it was the next chronological thing that was to happen, but that's not what Luke is doing. Luke is zooming in to tell a story of the narrative, zooming out, and then telling a story. It's exactly what he was doing as we see Paul come on the scene and Peter is still preaching, right? And he zooms in to a story of Paul, then he zooms out and zooms in to Peter. And what Luke is trying to do is he's trying to show these things kind of happening at the same time, at least with regard to the narrative is concerned. He's going to follow that same method here and to show you kind of how he lapses in his time, chapter 21 through 17, I'm sorry, 21 and 17, through 24 to 23, three chapters of narrative, describes the events that happened over 12 days. But then chapter 24, verses 24 through 27, three verses, accounts for 2 years. 25, the beginning of 25 to 28, takes about 8 months of time. And then just four verses at the end of 28 takes about 3 months. So this is not just something that happens one event after the other event after the other event. But Luke has taken these events and has stitched them next to each other for an overarching narrative. This narrative, the thing that we want, that he's trying to get us to see here, again, is Paul answering the critique that Christianity is somehow against the law, either the Jewish law or the Roman law. And what Luke is doing is making a point for Christ's divinity, his reason for worship, but he's also making a point in these four chapters of Christianity's civil peace. So verse 12, there's still foment going on with Paul. The next morning, the Jews had gathered secretly to make plans against Paul. They took an oath that they wouldn't eat or drink anything until they had killed him. There were more than 40 people, men who had taken part in this oath, that they were going to kill him. It was a special promise. And he says to the Romans, "Now you and the Sanhedrin must make an appeal to the commanding officer. Ask him to bring Paul to you. Pretend that you want more facts about the case, and when he comes back," that's whenever they're going to execute him. "But Paul's nephew heard about this plan." And I'll stop right here in verse half of verse 16 and talk about Paul's nephew. Who's Paul's nephew? I was dying to be able to figure out today who Paul's nephew was so I could explain it to you today, but we just don't know. They don't know who Paul's nephew is. He's just never mentioned through extra-biblical sources like Josephus. We just don't know. But somehow or another, Paul's nephew would not have arose suspicion if he was known to be Paul's nephew and still party to this plot to kill Paul, which means that given Paul's rejection of Judaism, of Jewish orthodoxy, it's probably very likely that there would have been members of his family that would have disowned him as a result. So it would at least not have been enough that his nephew, had he been known to be his nephew, that he wouldn't have been in the party whenever they were talking about going to kill Paul. So he goes to the fort and he tells Paul. Paul called one of the commanders and said to him, "Take this young man to the commanding officer, he has something to tell you." So the commander took Paul's nephew to the officer. The commander said, "Paul the prisoner has sent for me, and he asks me to bring this young man to you. This young man has something to tell you." The commanding officer took the young man by the hand. He spoke to him in private. "What do you want to tell me?" the officer said. He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul to the Sanhedrin tomorrow. Don't give in to them. They've taken an oath. They're not going to eat or drink till you're dead." So the commanding officer let the young man go, but he gave him a warning. "Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me." Then the commanding officer called for two of his commanders, and he ordered them, "Gather a company of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 men armed with spears. Get them ready to go to Caesarea at 9 o'clock tonight. Provide horses for Paul so that he may have been taken safely to Governor Felix," the Roman Governor Felix. Now, I just also want to stop right here and ask a question. So do we suppose that 400 soldiers, well, 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, and 70 horsemen are dedicated by the Roman commander? So Paul is a nobody, or Paul is definitely a somebody? Paul's definitely a somebody. They just didn't have almost 500 soldiers to guarantee the safety of just someone that was any old Roman citizen. Okay, I think that shows us something. And not only does he dedicate almost 500 military men to this process, but he sends a letter to the governor Felix as well, telling him that the Jews had grabbed hold of him. They were going to kill him, right? And what he's basically doing is he's saying, "I am providing for his safety because I haven't found that he's broken any of these laws, or what if he has broken laws, it's got something to do with the Jewish laws. What do we even care about that anyway? Right? This guy is a Roman citizen. I'm just protecting a Roman citizen because that's what we do. And they do. The soldiers, they take him to Caesarea. During the night that they brought him, they brought him as far as Antipatris, which is not quite Caesarea. The next day, they let the horsemen go with him, and the soldiers returned to the fort, arriving in Caesarea. They gave the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter. He asked Paul where he was from. He learned that Paul was from Caesarea, right? But that's capital is Tarsus. So he said, I'll hear your case when those bringing charges against you, right? So that when the Jewish people, when the Sanhedrin guys, when they show up here in town, then we'll have your trial. And then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. Again, typical of a prisoner or atypical of a prisoner? We're just going to keep you in the king's palace, right? Not in the dungeon, not in the jailhouse, but you're actually going to stay in the palace.
Is that like a house arrest?
Yes, that's exactly what it would be like.
House arrest.
So Paul spent 2 years in Caesarea, from the summer of 58 AD to the fall of 60 AD. Caesarea was the Roman capital of the province of Judea. And if we also will remember from our Bible story before, it was the place of the first Gentile convert into the church about 20 years before this. Cornelius, right? An officer of the Roman army, came from Caesarea. So this is the most important Roman city of Palestine. Paul spends 2 years as a prisoner in the palace of the Roman governor with the privilege of even being able to receive visitors, right? That's a pretty good opportunity to witness Christ as a prisoner. Pretty comfortable way to do it. It must also strike each one of us to notice that Luke devotes special attention throughout his work to the occasion when Paul is brought into contact with Roman officials. And we've seen this right from the second missionary journey to this time, that every time Paul seems to come in contact with a Roman official, somebody that you would expect would crack him over the head, generally on these occasions, the relationship between Paul and the Roman officials usually end in friendly ways. Right? The scene with the proconsul of Cyprus, where the proconsul actually goes to the prison, releases Paul, and apologizes. That's probably the most marked case. But Galileo, right, also dismissed the case against him. And the formal decision of him in Ephesus by a proconsul had so much weight that it actually set a precedent for, set a precedent for practically a declaration of religious liberty for the whole of the province. And so Paul, that's why we call tonight's lesson Paul, the original Teflon Don, right? Every time they try to get him thrown into jail forever, every time they finally, or they try to put an end to his gospel message, Paul slides away. So now we're in front of the governor Felix, chapter 24. 5 days later, Ananias, the high priest, went down to Caesarea. Some elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. So Tertullus is a local guy in Caesarea. Basically, the Sanhedrin had hired a local attorney to plead their case. That's Tertullus. Okay. They brought their charges against Paul to the governor. Paul was called in. Tertullus began to bring charges against Paul. He said to Felix, the Roman governor, "We've enjoyed a long time of peace while you've been ruling. You are a wise leader. You have made this a better nation. Most excellent Felix, we gladly admit this everywhere and in every way, and we are very thankful." Probably thinking that it probably doesn't hurt to butter up the judge, right? It's kind of what's happening here. "I don't want to bother you, but would you be kind enough to listen to us for a short time. And so Tertullus, this local attorney in Caesarea, lays out these horrendous charges against Paul. "We found Paul to be a troublemaker. He stirs up trouble amongst the Jews all over the world." And that's true. "He's a leader of those who follow the Jesus of Nazareth. He's even tried to pollute our own temple." If you recall last time, he was falsely accused of taking a Gentile into the temple courts with him. But he didn't take the Gentile. He happened to travel to Jerusalem with him. But there's no evidence that the Gentile was ever allowed into the temple. "And so we arrested him. Question him yourself. And then you'll learn the truth about all these charges we're bringing against him." So, we have come down from Jerusalem. He has been held in this house arrest. We've got to tell you, this guy's done some really bad things. So let me just lay out what they are. He's a pest. He's a Christian. And some people thought he tried to pollute the temple, but he really didn't try to pollute the temple. And we couldn't prove that if we tried, because the Asian Gentiles who were with him in Jerusalem have now returned to Asia. We couldn't even bring a witness to that charge, even if you asked us to. Now, Felix is the governor of Judea, and Christianity has begun to spread. Felix knew about the way of Jesus. So he put off the trial for the time being. This is not that important, Felix is thinking. Lysias, the commanding officer, will come, and then I'll decide your case. He ordered the commander to keep Paul under guard. He told him to give Paul some freedom, right? So not only is he living it up in the governor's palace, but he's even kind of told his guards, like, you know what? Just kind of keep an eye on him. Kind of make sure, you know, just keep him out of trouble. It's basically what he's saying. He's even allowed his friends to come in to care for his needs. So he's got friends, other Christians who are bringing him food to eat and clothes, fresh clothes to wear, all of these kind of things. Several days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, and she was a Jew. Felix sent up for Paul and listened to him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. Paul talked about how to live right. He talked about how people should control themselves. He talked about the time when God will judge everyone. And then Felix became afraid. "That's enough for now," he said. "You may leave. When I find time, I will send for you." Paul's talk of righteousness and of self-control and judgment to come must have been touchy issues for a governor who was noted for his ruthlessness. Tacitus, an ancient Roman writer, said of Governor Felix, "Practically every kind of cruelty and lust. He exercised royal power with the instincts of a slave." Just as Herod Antipas had been alarmed by the preaching of John the Baptist, remember, John the Baptist didn't really like with the way that Herod Antipas was kind of hanging around with his brother's ex-wife, right? And was really making trouble for him because John had gathered quite a following. John the Baptist was saying, "I don't think the king is living right. It's going to end up with him losing his head." And we kind of have the same thing going on here with Felix, a pretty bad guy, right? Felix may have been conscience-stricken by hearing Paul. He hears Paul and he hears this message of self-control and of moderation and morality. And perhaps it was just a little too close to home. However, Felix put off matters of faith and repentance just as he deferred passing judgment on Paul. See, he was hoping, we read verse 26, he was hoping that Paul would offer him some money to let him go. So he often sent for Paul and talked to him. Remember, he's allowed Paul's friends to come in. He's allowed food and money, and probably letters are going out. And this is a perfect time to kind of, "Hey man, how about a little something, you know, for the effort?" But Paul is just not interested in giving bribes. 2 years, verse 27, 2 years passed. Porcius Festus took the place of Felix, but Felix wanted to do the Jews a favor. So he left Paul in prison. Now, Felix was the governor or the procurator of Judea from the years 52 to 59. And he actually was a freed slave. Remember, Tacitus had said that he practiced every kind of cruelty and lust. And Felix promoted and provoked Jewish unrest. He was actually a cruel guy. He had the ability to crush Jewish rebellion whenever it sparked. And he would actually foment Jewish unrest so that he could crush them. And he was actually eventually ousted by Nero, right? The guy who lets Rome burn, the guy who named his own horse as a senator, crazy Nero. This guy kicks Felix out for being too bad of a guy. That's how bad Felix is. Now, why would this corrupt, crazy governor, Felix, why would he want to do the Jews a favor? Well, before these events, Paul, and this his trial and all this, before these events, there was a massive dispute in Caesarea as to whether Caesarea was going to be a Gentile or a Greek-controlled city or a Jewish-controlled city. And daggers were out towards each other at every turn. And eventually, mob violence erupts, and Felix dispatches his troops to help the Gentiles kill thousands of Jews in the city. Not only did he allow for thousands of Jews in the city to be killed, but he also allowed the soldiers to loot businesses and homes of Jewish people. His actions were so bad that the Jewish people at the end of the mob violence actually protested to Rome because of his actions. So what's he doing? He's trying to get on their good side. It didn't work, and Nero does, in fact, depose him as governor. This new guy, the guy that takes his place, is a guy by the name of Festus. And 3 days, chapter 25, 3 days after Festus arrived, he went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. There the chief priests and the Jewish leaders came to him, and they brought their charges against Paul. They tried to get Festus to have Paul taken to Jerusalem. And they asked this as a favor because they were planning to hide and attack and kill him. Festus answered, "Paul is being held at Caesarea, and soon I'll be going there myself. So let some of your leaders come with me, and if the man has done anything wrong, they can bring charges against him there." Festus spent 8 or 10 days in Jerusalem with them. Then he went down to Caesarea, the Roman capital. The next day he called the court together, and he ordered Paul brought to him. When Paul arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him. They brought many strong charges against him, and as always, they couldn't prove them. Now, finally, Paul speaks for himself, and he tells the court, "I've done nothing wrong," and here it is. "I've done nothing wrong against the law of the Jews or against the temple. I have done nothing wrong against Caesar." Remember, these four speeches in these four chapters, each one of them is Luke showing the reader how Christianity is not designed, intended, nor was it to be a source of civil unrest. But Festus wanted to do the Jews a favor, so he said to Paul, now remember, why are these guys wanting to do the Jews a favor? Because at every drop of the hat, there is some sort of rebellion. And when Roman proconsuls or governors can't handle the rebellions that take place in Judea, they end up getting removed. Right? He's trying to keep everybody calm here. So he asks Paul, "Hey, these guys have come up with a possible solution. Would you go to Jerusalem? Can we have your trial there in Jerusalem? Are you willing to face these charges in my court?" And Paul says, "I'm already standing in Caesar's court." Remember, he's talking to the Roman governor. in court. He's saying, I don't need to go anywhere else. For look, Caesar's law is the law of the land. I'm already in court. This is where I should go to trial. It's already been proven. I haven't done anything wrong to the Jews. And he tells Felix, or I'm sorry, he tells Festus, you know this very well. He says, if I'm guilty of anything else, if I'm worthy of death, I'm willing to die. But these things that they keep saying, the reason why I should still go down and be held for trial in Jerusalem just isn't true. He said, no one has the right to hand me, I'm a Roman citizen, over to them. They are not Roman citizens. And then he says the magic words, I make my appeal to Caesar. It's a Roman citizen. Perceiving that Festus might yield to these Jewish authorities, that it might give in and let him take him back to Jerusalem and be killed, Paul appeals to Caesar. It was the right of every Roman citizen, if they request, to be tried before the imperial tribunal in Rome. This course of events will eventually allow the Lord's prophecy that Paul would preach in Rome to be fulfilled. So, Festus talked it over with the members of his court, and he said, you've made an appeal to Caesar, and to Caesar you will go. A guy who was king at the time, Marcus Julius Agrippa II, was the son of Herod Agrippa I. He was brought up at Rome in the court of Claudius, and like his father, was also a favorite of the emperor. As his father's death in 44, he was only 17 years old, which meant he was too young to rule over his father's domain. Therefore, Palestine became a Roman province administered by a provincial governor. But in 50, Claudius appointed King Agrippa II, king of a petty kingdom to the northeast of Judea. As a ruler of an adjoining kingdom to the north, Herod Agrippa II came to pay his respects to Festus. That's why we find King Agrippa II now hanging out with Festus as the new governor of Judea. When Agrippa with Berenice, your Bible might say Bernice, but the name is more properly translated Berenice. That is his sister of 1 year younger than he. She married her uncle, their uncle, Herod, the king of Chalcis. But he died in 48 AD, so Berenice came to live with her brother Agrippa. Rumors of their incestuous relationship flourished in both Rome and Palestine. Verse 13, a few days later, King Agrippa and Berenice arrived in Caesarea. They had come to pay a visit to Festus. They were spending many days there, so Festus talked with the king about Paul's case. He says, there's a man that Felix just left as a prisoner. And when I went to Jerusalem, the Jewish chief priests and the elders brought charges against him. And they wanted him to be found guilty. I told them it's not the way Romans do things. We don't judge people before they face those bringing charges against them. They have to have a chance to speak up for themselves. Verse 19, instead they argued with him about their own beliefs. They didn't agree about this dead man named Jesus. There he could be tried on these charges, but Paul made an appeal to have the emperor decide his case. So I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I'd like to hear this man for myself. Festus says, all right, tomorrow is the day. The imperial officials are represented as Paul's only safeguard from the Jews. Paul is a Pharisee of the tribe of Benjamin. He studied under the famed Rabbi Gamaliel. Before becoming a Christian, he persecuted Christians. The only thing that is separating Paul from death at the hands of his Jewish brothers are the Romans. And how their friendly disposition to Paul is emphasized by Luke. Even Felix, who was one of the worst Roman officials, is affected by Paul's teaching. And on the whole, protects Paul. Right? Even though he might have had sordid motives like wanting a bribe, right? And even though he finally left Paul bound because he wanted a deal with the Jews, right? But there was no actual official action by Felix against Paul. Festus, Felix's successor, is described as just and fair with Paul. He found him not worthy of death, had difficulty discovering any definite charge against him that he could report when sending him for trial before the Supreme Court of the Empire. This man, this Roman citizen, has requested a trial at the imperial tribunal in Rome. I am to send along a report saying I have thoroughly examined the matters, and this guy is clearly guilty or he is clearly innocent. And Festus here has no idea what to write in this letter, whatever he sends him to Rome, because there's no reason why this guy should even have to face trial in Rome. So verse 23 of chapter 25, remember Agrippa and Berenice, they show up and they act like very important people. They're entered into the courtroom. The most important officers, the leading men of the city, came with them. And when Festus gave the command, Paul was then brought in. Festus said, King Agrippa and all who are here with us, take a good look at this man. Both in Jerusalem and in here, in Caesarea, there are a large number of Jews who have come to me about him. They keep shouting that he shouldn't even live any longer. I have found that he hasn't done anything worthy of death. But he made his appeal to the emperor, and I've decided to send him to Rome. I don't have anything certain to write about him to his majesty, so I brought him here today. Now all of you will be able to hear him. King Agrippa, it will be very good for you to hear him. As a result of this hearing, maybe I'll have something to write. Because it doesn't make sense to send a prisoner to Rome without listing the charges against him. There are no charges against him. So Agrippa tells Paul, you can speak. So Paul motions with his hand and begins his defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself fortunate to stand before you today as I make my defense against all of these accusations of the Jews, especially so because you are well acquainted with all the Jewish customs and controversies. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. It must have been that Paul recognized Agrippa for two things. One, being an intelligent guy. And two, remember his wife, or he comes from a Jewish family, so he's going to be cognizant, aware of Jewish law and customs. So he's not going to have to explain Jewish law and custom as well as defending his case. The Jewish people all know the way I have lived ever since I was a child, from the beginning of my life in my own country and also Jerusalem. They've known me for a long time. And they could testify, if they're willing, that I conform to the strictest sect of our religion. Right? And like he loves being a Pharisee. He says, I'm a Pharisee, and now it's my hope that what God has promised our ancestors, it's for that reason that I'm on trial today. Basically, what Paul is saying is God promised us a deliverer. God promised us a Messiah, and I believe that that Messiah has come. And that's the only thing, that's the only reason why I am on trial today, right? And either that or because I believe that the Messiah was raised from the dead. And so let me ask you, why should any of you consider it incredible if God, the creator of the universe, can actually raise people from the dead? And we've got to remember that it's not in spite of his Jewish heritage, but because of it, Paul insisted that he believed and proclaimed what he did. Right? This is important because Paul didn't see himself as something outside of his Jewishness. He saw himself as a Jew whose ultimate messianic promise had been fulfilled. He wasn't the founder of a new religion, or Christ rather, wasn't the founder of a new religion of which he was one of the chief salesmen. He just saw the Hebrew scriptures, the promises contained therein by Yahweh being fulfilled through Jesus. Right? And so what he's saying is, I'm not trying to ignore that I'm a Jew. In fact, that's what I'm trying to make a point of. Right? He's saying, it's because I'm a Jew that I'm proclaiming it the way that I am. So he begins the body of his address here by drawing back to that Pharisaic background and his Christian commitment, arguing that the Jewish hope and the Christian message are inseparably related. Jewish hope for a future and the Christian message are the same message, is what Paul is trying to say. His life had been spent amongst his people in his own country, in Sicilia, and in Jerusalem, and he had lived as the strictest member of the Pharisees, right? Because they had the hope of resurrection in the dead. Ironically, the charges against him were brought of all people by the Jews themselves. Yet why should any of his audience think it incredible that God should raise from the dead? Particularly when God had validated the truth of resurrection by raising Jesus from the dead. And he's saying, I am convinced, chapter 9, or verse 9, I am convinced, right, that I should oppose Jesus in every way until I had my experience on the road to Damascus. And then the second part of his story here, of his narrative, he continues to retell the story of his own conversion and how he had come in contact with other Christians whenever he had actually had his own Christophany. In other words, his own experience of a vision of Christ, right? Whom says, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. Right? So then, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to that vision from heaven, verse 19. First to those in Damascus, remember that's where he was taken. Then to Jerusalem and Judea, then to the Gentiles. I preached that they should repent and turn to God and demonstrate their repentance by their deeds, which is exactly what all of the apostles were called to do. And God has helped me to this very day, so I stand here to testify to small and great alike. I'm saying nothing beyond what the prophets and Moses said would happen, that the Messiah would suffer, as the first to rise from the dead would bring the message of light to his own people and to the Gentiles. That's in our own scriptures, guys. At this point, Festus interrupted Paul's defense. You are out of your mind, Paul. Again, finding no fault, just saying, I think you've gotten too big for your britches. All of this book learning, Festus is saying, has driven you a little bit crazy. I'm not insane, most excellent Festus. What I'm saying is true and reasonable. King's familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I'm convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. And he says, King Agrippa, remember, coming from a Jewish family, he says, King Agrippa, do you believe in the prophets? I know you do. And whenever he says this to Agrippa, he's painted Agrippa into a corner. How does Agrippa answer? Does he say that he doesn't believe in prophets and turn his back on his Jewish heritage? Or does he say that he does believe in prophets and go, well, it sounds like the story is true here. He's kind of got Agrippa in a theological corner here. And Agrippa says to Paul, I think this is really great. He says, do you think that in such a short time that you can persuade me to be a Christian? Like, you're going to have to try a little bit harder than that, Paul. Paul says, short time or long, I pray to God that not only you, but all who are listening to me today may become what I am, except for, and you can imagine him rattling these chains. The king rose, and with his governor and Berenice and those sitting with him, after they left the room, they began saying to one another, this man is not doing anything that deserves death or imprisonment. Agrippa says to Festus, this man could have been set free if not that he appealed to Caesar. Had he not said the magic words that forces me to send him to Rome, I'd let him go right now, but I can't. I can't because he's asked me to send him to Rome, and I cannot be seen as denying him an opportunity before the imperial tribunal in Rome. I could have let him go today, but he is on his way to Rome. As Felix said, to Caesar you shall go. Paul had the last word, and his light touch here, I think, at the end of his response, evidently broke up the meeting. With it, Agrippa dismissed the proceedings, and Festus and Berenice strode out of the audience chamber to discuss the situation. Agrippa had presumably heard enough to instruct Festus what he should write in this report that will go with him to Rome. Their conclusion was that Paul had done nothing that in Rome's eyes should merit death or imprisonment. Even Agrippa was heard to comment, "This man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar." This comment should not be taken to mean that a provincial governor could not free a prisoner after appeal to Caesar. In this situation, however, Paul's status was not a question of law, but also politics. With these words, Luke concludes his apologetic motif in the Acts of the Apostle, in which he sets out to vindicate both Paul and Christianity from any suspicion of sedition or treason or political unrest. And next time, when we get together, we will see this incredibly remarkable adventure as they go to Rome, and eventually that will be the end of our story of the Acts of the Apostles, and we'll suppose, when it's all said and done, what exactly happens to Paul and his old buddy Peter when they're in Rome. Spoiler alert, they both die. Any questions?
What's after Acts?
What are we going to do after Acts? Genesis.
Oh, cool. Okay. That's going to be interesting to me.
All right.
Well, this is too, but you know what I meant.
Well, there you have it. I hope that this episode was as enlightening for you on the story of the Acts of the Apostles as it was for me to prepare. I hope that you'll join us next time as we follow Paul on his travels to Rome. It's going to be quite an adventure. Hey, before we go, if you could take the moment to like and subscribe to the podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. However it is that you may listen to our podcast, if there is a way that you can rate and review the podcast, we'd certainly appreciate it because it helps get the podcast out to other people. Well, friends, until next time, I hope that you are blessed, and I pray that you'll be a blessing.